Okay, any preliminary issues, questions? We spent yesterday looking at the question of how you define a nuisance, hopefully made some progress in clarifying that concept. Today we're going to spend some time looking at the question of remedies for a finding that something is a nuisance and sort of explore some of the related questions about how this body of law relates to other areas like property, for example, where we, in effect, evaluate different interests in property and determine how different interests in land can be transferred. So, as I said, the primary thing we're looking at is, assuming something is a nuisance, what remedies can the plaintiff obtain for such a finding? So, no, who's been neglected here that I haven't given a chance to spend time in the sun here? Mr. LeBanc, have you done one of these? Well, why don't you tell us about Boomer? Actually, Boomer's the plaintiff. It's the, yeah. So what's the procedural history here? What does the plaintiff seek by way of remedy? Yeah, what's the difference between those? Okay, if you didn't impose an injunction, what remedy would the plaintiff have? Okay, and would the defendant presumably be, if let's say the court says it's $10,000 worth of damage for putting up with 3 years of cement dust, if there were no equitable relief, what would happen after the judge or the court imposes that judgment? Why not? New damages? I mean, new injury, new damages? Every 3 years you go to court and collect your $10,000? Why not? If the harm is ongoing, the defendant couldn't, if the defendant keeps imposing harm, you know, if I walk out in the street and somebody runs over me and puts me in the hospital with a broken arm, and I get out of the hospital and then you run me over again, presumably I get another round of damages. Well, if our only remedy were to look to the past and say, in the past the defendant did this to the plaintiff is entitled to compensation, here plaintiff is your compensation, there wouldn't be anything in theory, would there, to prevent the plaintiff from coming back a little bit like Bill Murray in Groundhog Day, coming back again and getting his damages again. But of course the plaintiff doesn't want that. In this case the defendant actually would be quite happy with that result. Instead of doing that, the court has the idea that saving the plaintiff the annoyance of coming back year after year or on a 3-year cycle or whatever to seek damages, we'll simply calculate what those damages are into the future and award them as a lump sum to the plaintiff now, and the plaintiff will then be fully compensated for all of the harm they have suffered and we expect the plaintiff to suffer. Why isn't that a satisfactory remedy from the plaintiff's standpoint? I mean, think about it. If you were a plaintiff and your neighbor did something annoying to you and the court determined that it was an annoyance and the court figured out what it would cost, what the fair market value of the annoyance was, and then awarded that sum of money to you, why would you be grumpy about that outcome? But you get compensated for it. And let's assume we accurately assess the diminution in the fair market value of your home caused by this nuisance. Well, but the defendant would argue that it takes care of the problem at too high a price. That is, the defendant accepts the notion that to the extent that they cause harm, they have to compensate for that harm. What the defendant doesn't accept is the idea that after the plaintiff has been compensated for the past harm, and after the defendant is in effect offered to pay for whatever future harm there might be, the plaintiff can say, no, that's not good enough. I want you to move. I want you to shut down. I demand that you shut down, and expects the court to comply. On what basis can the plaintiff insist on not just compensatory damages but an injunction? Why would you feel, you know, if somebody took your laptop and we did a quick eBay search and we found out what this model of laptop with this size hard drive and this much software on it, and okay, here's what it's worth, and I'll give you that, and I take your laptop, Ms. Anderson. Why not? Okay, the servitude thing is this technical property stuff, and we'll get to that. I'm not saying that's not what we're talking about, but I want to make sure we focus on this idea of what is unconstitutional about it. You mean I can't just take your laptop and plunk you know, $850 or whatever its fair market value is on the table and say, hey, we're even. Right. The whole idea of owning property, whether you own a laptop or you own a house in the suburbs, is I pay taxes on this. It's my land. There's something kind of special about that sense of ownership. And one of the powers we have not given to government is the idea that government can simply decide, well, I know you like your laptop, but he needs it right now, and he's willing to pay you compensation, so we're going to let him take it from you so long as he pays you just compensation. What would happen, for example, if some farmer who, for some strange reason, wanted to continue growing his crops when there was a, you know, a real estate developer eager to take that land and put it to productive use and build a shopping center or a subdivision, and all the rest of us decide the farmer is standing in the way of progress, and we say to the real estate developer, you just put up the money that we decide is the fair value of this property, and it's yours. We would be outraged by that, would we not, if government allowed that to take place. And so the question here is whether or not the cement company is being permitted to do the same thing. Are they? Is the cement company, as Judge Jason suggests, being permitted in effect to exercise powers that are constitutionally forbidden to it? Well, first of all, let's go back and see if we can understand the difference. Well, this is sort of a little historical interlude here. You'll spend more time on this in civil procedure, but where is this whole idea of equity and injunctions, where does that all come from? It does. And where did those courts come from? Did somebody sit down with an organizational chart and say, well, we need these kinds of courts and we need those kinds of courts? But it wasn't set up because somebody drew it out on an organizational chart. What happened I'm only giving you the crudest kind of overview of this, but in effect you had what were called the law courts, the standard kinds of courts that dealt with cases at law, things like property, some property disputes, but contract cases, broken contracts, torts, unpaid debts, things like that. And in order to file your claim in one of these courts, as I think I've said before, you originally had to fall within what they called a form of action. That is, it was in a sumpset, or it was in trover, or it was conversion, or it was trespass, or it was some other, you know, form of action that was recognized. And the remedy for it was in the form of it was a legal remedy. It was either the award of a piece of property. So, for example, in something like trover, I would say, hey, that property belongs to me. My neighbor took it. And he says, no, I bought it fair and square. The action for trover would be essentially to return the property to its rightful owner. And the court could award the property and say, okay, that property really belongs to this other person. Or in a sumpset, the court could say, you owe this debt. Or in tort, they could say, here are the damages for this particular wrong. But not every case fell into one of those kinds of pigeonholes. And in particular, where you had, for example, a life tenant of property, and you may know as you're studying property that one way to distribute your property is to say, upon my death, I want my property to go to my wife as long as she shall live, and upon her death to go to my children. Well, the wife then has, the widow has a life estate. As long as she lives, she controls the property, but upon her death, it would go to her children. Or I might give it to somebody for their life, and then upon their death, it goes to some charity. Or I have some other way of dividing the life estate from the remainder. Now, in a case like that, if the life tenant is abusing the property, wasting it, allowing it to be messed up, what's my remedy? Do I go seek damages for that? No. What I want is for someone to intervene to protect that property for the rightful beneficiaries. Or, for example, I may create a trust in which I say, I give this money to so-and-so in trust for the beneficiary. And the trustee turns out to be unreliable, and I want someone to force the trustee to do the right thing with it. Well, the appeal was not to the courts of law, because the courts of law were kind of confined to these forms of action, and instead the appeal was to a person that had more general equitable powers, a kind of residual power to do justice. And as if you know the story of Thomas More in the movie A Man for All Seasons or otherwise, he is the Chancellor of England, at least until Henry gets mad at him. But his predecessor as Chancellor of England was Cardinal Wolsey, who obviously, Cardinal Bishop, there was an ecclesiastical connection between the courts of equity. Courts of equity would be too strong. It was essentially, it started with the Chancellor to whom people would appeal, asking the Chancellor to do justice, to say, in effect, the money for my care was entrusted to so-and-so, and he's spending it all on his own consumption. I want you to order him to give me the money that, or to pay the money for my welfare as the trust provided. So the Chancellor could order these things in this equitable way, not based upon some legal judgment, but upon the general obligation to force people to do what was right. Now, in the modern system, like the modern federal courts, these functions, the courts of law or legal remedies and equitable remedies, have been merged into a single system. The same federal judge who sits down on Riverside Avenue is a judge who both presides over broken contracts and tort cases and criminal cases, as well as a judge to whom you appeal for equitable relief. If you want an injunction to stop the bulldozers from tearing down a historic landmark, or you want an injunction to declare some statute unconstitutional, or whatever you want the federal judge to do, we don't have two different court systems. Thankfully, because as the history of England reflects, there was a lot of confusion about what kinds of cases fell into whose jurisdiction and when you had to go here and when you had to go there. Okay, but the power of the court to order equitable remedies, in particular injunctions to force somebody to do something, is a pretty extraordinary power. Most of the time, injunctions are in a prohibitive capacity. It's to stop the bulldozers from running. But there are circumstances in which a judge has the power to actually make you do something. So that, for example, if you are a county commissioner and you're not providing sufficient medical care for your jail inmates, and someone persuades the federal judge that it's a violation of the Eighth Amendment, the federal judge may order the county commissioners to provide proper medical care. They may order, you know, the desegregation of a school district. They may order the restructuring of a prison system, etc. So equitable powers take on, you know, pretty extraordinary proportions because they're not limited by simply saying, okay, here's a remedy in damages. It actually has the power to coerce. And there is a fairly lively debate over either the benefits that society derives from having people in the judiciary with independence who can sort of step into this equitable role and do what is right, versus people who think that judges have overstepped their bounds in many cases and have become so-called imperial judiciary. And again, the debate about how much authority should be assumed by judges in making these kinds of decisions is very much, as I say, a lively debate. Now, back to Boomer here. Boomer wants an injunction against the cement company, but the court won't give it to him. Why not? Yeah. Well, let's talk about both those. What is the suppose we assessed Boomer's damages at $50,000 and we said that the cost to the cement company of closing down or trying to move their operation was $5 million. Would that have any bearing on the decision as to whether or not the plaintiff was entitled to an injunction? Well, if you're trying to be equitable, you would look long and hard before you said to yourself, is there any sort of socially redeeming value here in what the defendant is doing? How strong is the plaintiff's expectation here? Again, to the extent that nuisance revolves around a finding that the plaintiff reasonably expected that the defendant not harm the plaintiff in that particular way, a showing that the defendant's behavior, that at the time he built this plant, people weren't as sensitive to environmental issues as they later became, that would have some bearing on saying whether or not the plaintiff was really reasonable in thinking you've got to stop and you've got to stop now. There's another reason why the majority of the court is reluctant to enter an injunction here. What's that? Now, actually, before we get there, let's go back to this whole property issue. What little I know about property law, you mentioned this idea of an equitable servitude. What's that? Yeah, what's an equitable servitude? You haven't done that in property, I trust. Okay. So it's all Rylands versus Fletcher. Okay. Have you talked about the idea of property, sort of this bundle of sticks idea, that in the same way I talked about a life estate and the remainder interest and the mineral rights and the this and the that, you can think of the ownership not as some unitary, I either own property or I don't own property, but if I own property, as they say, fee simple absolute, I own the entire bundle of sticks comprising that property, but I can begin to have some of those. I can either give them away or sell them or have them taken from me. I can do things like easements where I say, okay, I own the property, but I give you the right to travel over some part of the property to get to and from your property or to service your oil well or maintain your electric lines or something. I can, again, sell away the mineral rights, or I can sell, you know, the rights to the airspace above my property to somebody else. I can do all kinds. I can rent it out for periods of time, what have you. One of the things I can do is I can sell the idea of an equitable servitude. And the equitable servitude here is that this property, in effect, serves the property of the cement company by serving as a dumping ground. And again, this has been involuntarily transferred from the plaintiffs who do not willingly sell it, but it has been, in effect, a compulsory sale of the property to the cement company. They now own the right to dump their cement dust on it. Sort of own it. Why don't they own it in a more absolute sense? The right to dump cement dust on the plaintiff's property can be taken away from them at a later date. By whom? Ms. Imadapur, yes. Okay. Some kind of environmental regulation. And in fact, the court is conscious of the fact that there is a governmental agency. I can't remember how young or old the Environmental Protection Agency is, whether they're mentioned by name here, or whether they're sort of out there as a concept. But the point is that there are efforts underway to identify the levels of pollution that would be harmful, and if those levels are exceeded, they could be prohibited. And this court doesn't want to preempt that, in effect. They're saying, you know, the plaintiffs will have an opportunity later on to convince the government that the defendants' levels of emissions are too high. And we don't really know all the factors that go into that. There's economics, there's health data, there's other kinds of stuff to figure out at what point do you say there's too much of this in the air. Again, as one of the ongoing themes in this class is the way in which courts relate to coordinate branches of government. In this case, we see the court, in effect, deferring, passing the buck, just as they did in Hammondtree versus Jenner, to say, maybe it would be a good idea to limit the amount of pollution that the defendants generate. But we're not going to make that call. We're going to allow the governmental agencies that have expertise, that have the opportunity to kind of experiment with different ways, technological solutions, how to transition from a smokestack economy to a different kind of economy. We don't want to pretend that we have that level of expertise. Now, the plaintiffs obviously would be unhappy with that because they don't trust the governmental agencies. The plaintiffs would be afraid that the governmental agencies will be subservient to people with political influence who will look less to the public interest and more to who's making the largest campaign contributions or who has the biggest clout in the political process. So again, you have this, as I said earlier, a kind of different perspective on whether we should place more trust in agencies with technical expertise, but yes, politically influenced, or should we put more trust in the judiciary, which is independent, but arguably out of touch. They don't have the sort of sensitivity. They live in a kind of ivory tower, so to speak, and they can look at people like, you know, pieces on a chessboard, but they're not accountable in the way the political process is. And as I say, there are advocates of both positions who would urge that we should put more emphasis on one place rather than another in terms of solving social problems. So, again, what's happened here is the split between the damages remedy and the injunctive remedy, such that the plaintiff in Boomer gets damages but no injunction. In Spur, we essentially have the opposite scenario. As I said before, same kind of problem, mixed bag, and the court's trying to be somewhat creative. Yes, ma'am. Not in terms of this judgment, because again, the equitable servitude goes with the land. Same way that I grant an easement to my neighbor to let him drive his tractor across my driveway, when I go to sell my property, the easement goes with it. And that's the beauty of our property system, is that we can do all these creative things of dividing up the property and sell it and reconfigure it and do all these timeshare and so forth. Obviously, it creates the potential that in all this tricky configuration, we mess it up. Stuff gets lost, people get confused, lines get improperly drawn, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, Spur. Mr. Patel, have you done one of these things? Okay, why don't you tell us about Spur? Okay. And as it turns out, we've got the city of Phoenix over here, and we've got Spur essentially out in the middle of nowhere, and the city of Phoenix is expanding, but Del Webb moves in right next to Spur. And I don't know exactly how he gets customers. Maybe he sells on the internet, or he waits till there's a northwest wind to show people the property, or somehow he gets them to buy this stuff, and then when the wind shifts, they get unhappy. Okay, so what is Del Webb's claim against Spur? Okay, so that this the emissions from this feedlot constitute a nuisance. What is Spur's response to that claim? Yeah. Okay, and so the legal effect of that, there's a particular doctrine that Spur wants to argue. What's that doctrine? Yeah, or coming to the nuisance. Okay, and what is the effect of a finding that the plaintiff came to the nuisance? What's the legal significance or legal effect of a finding that the plaintiff came to the nuisance? Not only that an injunction can't be awarded, Well, remember, the injunction is not, there's the damages award, and then there's the injunction. So a defendant who says, well, maybe my operation is offensive to the plaintiff, but after all, the plaintiff came to the nuisance, the legal effect would be to say it's not a nuisance anymore as to the plaintiff. Why not? What relevance does the order that the order of the odor, I guess, would be the problem here, that if it's there first and the plaintiff moves in next door, why does that defeat a claim for nuisance? So says the defendant. But again, why does that make a difference to us? I understand it, but connect it legally. What is the criterion for deciding whether something's a nuisance? It's a nuisance if it... Okay, but what's the other thing we've talked about before, Mr. Cafferty? Oh, then I thought you're just scratching your ear there. All right. Sure, you certainly may. It's not so much about causing it. I mean, the plaintiff, yeah, Mr. Taylor. Well, the defendant's continuing to grow, or, you know, to fatten up cattle there. Ms. Riley? Reasonable expectation. Remember, there are definition of a nuisance is defendant interferes with the plaintiff's reasonable expectation. Well, how can you have a reasonable expectation whatever, normal suburban life, if you move in right next to a feedlot? Similar idea that if you buy a house on Bourbon Street in New Orleans, you can't have a reasonable expectation that everyone will, go home at, 6 o'clock in the evening and watch sitcoms and go to bed at 10 o'clock at night. If you try to get a judge to shut down your neighbor's raucous parties at 2 in the morning on Bourbon Street, the judge would say, what's wrong with you? So, again, the significance of coming to the nuisance is the plaintiff's expectation would not be reasonable. Now, one of the important points to remember here is that this doctrine of coming to the nuisance is not an absolute bar, as this case illustrates. Instead, it's simply a factor to be considered in deciding whether the plaintiff's expectations are reasonable or not. What does the court ultimately conclude with respect to whether the plaintiff is entitled to have this declared a nuisance? Okay, so what we've done is the exact opposite of what we did in Boomer. In Boomer, we gave the plaintiff damages, but we denied them an injunction. Here we give them an injunction, but we actually award the defendant damages for the cost of moving. How can that be? Why not? Now, they pose an alternative scenario, contrafactual scenario. They're saying if it had happened in this other way, things would have been different. Namely, they say if the city of Phoenix had simply grown sort of organically, and the boundary had gradually been pushed out closer and closer, and finally it essentially expanded right up to the boundary of the feedlot. Then would Spur would Del Webb have to indemnify Spur? Why not? Right. So there again, to the extent that that in sitting in its role as a court of equity, in considering a request for equitable relief, the court has the ability, in fact, the obligation to take into account a variety of circumstances that that might temper the remedy. So in this case, as you were pointing out, Del Webb, in effect, took advantage of the fact that this land right next to a feedlot didn't have value to very many other people. He got it cheap. To some extent, he apparently engaged in some degree of fast dealing here to persuade people to buy this to buy the land in this subdivision. So to that extent, Del Webb is hardly a guy with clean hands, as they say. The expression is you must come to a court of equity with clean hands, and Del Webb's not in that position. On the other hand, the court believes that there is a place for a finding of nuisance here. In fact, the court's kind of bound to it, and one of the reasons I'm guessing that they feel that way is because they make a finding that it's a public nuisance as well as a private nuisance. So let me just talk about that distinction for a moment. Public nuisances are those things declared by statute. They may be county ordinance or state a statute or municipal ordinance, but there are things declared to be public nuisances, not sort of at all times and everywhere. One of the oldest examples would be operating a house of prostitution would be considered a public nuisance, and you could have your property closed or other kinds of injunctions imposed if you were accused of doing that. The modern version of that, there's some of the former as well, but you often have owners of downtown property cited for having property that serves as a hangout for people who are using drugs. So that if an abandoned piece of property becomes a hangout where drugs are sold and drugs are being used, it destroys the value of the neighboring property. Now, public nuisances, first of all, are determined by whether they fall within a statutory list. And the other thing is that the only people who can really claim a public nuisance are either those people who are in law enforcement, the county prosecutor or the state attorney general or the like, or someone who suffers a particular injury from it. So even if I believe it with good reason that there is a crack house being operated near downtown someplace, unless I live next door or have some direct effect from it, I have no standing to pursue a claim for a public nuisance. The authorities do, and the people who live right next door have that right as well. But a private nuisance doesn't have to fall on a list of some statute someplace. Instead, a private nuisance is, as one Supreme Court justice put it, a pig in a parlor, something that's out of place, that doesn't belong. So it may be that there is a place for municipal landfills, that there's a place for gaslight factories or for cement plants or for feedlots, like the Panhandle of Texas, for example. But they don't belong right next to a residential neighborhood. So the plaintiff who's arguing a private nuisance merely has to show this discrepancy, essentially. I have a reasonable expectation to be free of this particular kind of harm, and the defendant's activity imposes this kind of harm on me. For example, I'm in a residential area. The defendant's operating some kind of business where there are cars parked around the block all the time. It's like a big parking lot. I can't even park my own car. My driveway is frequently blocked off because there are people parked in it, and it's a nuisance. If I can show, again, I have a reasonable expectation for some kind of enjoyment of my property, which the defendant's activity is interfering with, that can be a private nuisance, even though it's not like running some kind of a business or having, for example, somebody who has yard sales every weekend, you know, a garage sale, and they got stuff out on the lawn all the time. I don't know where all this stuff comes from, but gee, every weekend it's there, and there are all these people coming, streaming in and out all the time, walking over my flowers and so forth. Okay, again, I can argue that that's a nuisance simply by showing the relationship between my reasonable expectations and what the defendant is doing. Ms. Richardson. Yeah. Right. That's a good question. The court would be put in a much tougher position there because on the one hand the equity of telling the individuals, no, you don't get this relief, you have to put up with the stink, that doesn't seem quite right. At the same time, as you point out, ordering these homeowners to pay for the cost of moving doesn't seem fair either. So it is handy here again. The court is fortunate to have a deep pocket there, a deep pocket who in effect deserves to pay, to kind of put this creative remedy together. So again, you may look at this and say, good for the court, you know, they're using their noodles there and you're coming up with thinking outside the box a little bit here and coming up with a good solution. You may also be thinking, you know, hard cases make bad law, and it's when judges start thinking outside the box, they're more likely to mess things up than when they simply stick to their knitting and follow the precedents. Okay, I want to say one last thing before we make the transition here to the last section, and that is to say that the last section on animals, we do talk about animals, but there's another thing we talk about in that section which has to do with the leash law. And I want to point out that the leash law in the next case in Williams is one species, as it were, of a larger class of statutes that create strict liability. And maybe when I redo my casebook the next time, I'll do a new section D called statutory strict liability. And as I mentioned before, there's nothing crazy about having the legislature create strict liability for certain kinds of things, like hazardous waste disposal. And I've already mentioned the fact that there's a statute that says essentially people who generate hazardous waste are strictly liable for the harm that's caused when that hazardous waste is improperly disposed of or leaks out of the place where it was originally deposited. I gave an exam a couple of years back that had a statute in the exam that said anyone who sells alcohol to a minor is responsible for the injuries caused if the minor's intoxication results in injury to somebody else. And to somewhat to my disappointment, but I realized I hadn't made it clear before I gave the exam, and I'm remedying that now, the horse being gone, but the barn door still needing to be closed here, the point is that it was not in the, in fact, the trial judge interpreted it, just to prove my students were in good company. Like the trial judge, many of them read the statute as the same thing as saying, thou shalt not sell alcohol to minors. But notice the difference in the way I express the statute that says people who sell alcohol are liable for the harm that's caused by that. If it's simply a negligence standard where excuse, for example, would be relevant, or where a non-Cardozo jurisdiction would not necessarily hold a violation of the statute to be negligence in itself, but if, by contrast, the statute says people who do this are subject to strict liability, there's nothing crazy about that, any more than there's anything crazy about the legislature saying if you own a dog, you're strictly liable if the dog gets out and bites somebody. We'll pick that up on Monday.